This is Audible.
Welcome. You are about to embark on a unique learning adventure from The Great Courses. Our courses are crafted to be entertaining journeys, both comprehensive and fascinating. They're designed to expand horizons, deepen understanding, and foster epiphanies in a broad array of subjects and university-level disciplines. The lecturers are university professors and subject matter experts carefully selected by The Great Courses and its customers for their intellectual distinction and exceptional abilities to teach. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or visit our website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the company of some of the greatest minds in the world. These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. These lectures are titled, Writing Great Fiction, Storytelling Tips and Techniques. Your lecturer is Professor James Hines. Professor Hines is a working novelist who has taught creative writing as a visiting professor at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop, the University of Michigan, and Grinnell College, among other schools. He holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in Philosophy from the University of Michigan and a Master of Fine Arts degree from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Professor Hines is the author of several works of fiction, including Next, Kings of Infinite Space, The Lecturer's Tale, The Wild Colonial Boy, and Publish and Perish, Three Tales of Tenure and Terror. His book reviews and literary essays have appeared in the New York Times, The Washington Post, Boston Review, and other publications. Lecture 1. Starting the Writing Process.
Few things make a writer more anxious than facing a blank page. It doesn't matter if you're a beginner starting your first story ever, or if you're a battle-scarred old professional with many publications behind you. Having to fill that blank space with words is almost always a very intimidating prospect. Like any worker faced with a difficult task, a writer can find all sorts of ways to allay that anxiety. These include petty rituals of procrastination, like, say, alphabetizing your bookshelf, experimenting with different fonts on your computer, or sharpening all your pencils to just the right length. Some writers go further, indulging in such self-destructive practices as using alcohol or drugs to numb their anxiety. And ever since the advent of the Internet, there's been a vast middle ground between these two extremes, now that a writer is able to kill almost all his writing time by checking his email, making wisecracks on Twitter, or watching adorable kittens on YouTube and calling it research. A more fruitful approach is to stop and think about what the opening of a story is supposed to do, and that's pretty simple. The beginning of a story is supposed to make the reader want to keep reading. It's supposed to draw readers in, capture their curiosity, make them want to find out more. The beginning should also suggest something important about the story, who the main characters are, what the tone is, where the story is set, anything, as long as it hooks the reader and turns out to be important later on. The opening, in other words, should be evocative of the rest of the story as a whole. But even knowing this doesn't necessarily allay the writer's anxiety. Even if you know the story that you want to tell, how do you know where to enter into it? How do you take that first step? How do you decide what that first paragraph, that first sentence, that first word should be? Let me suggest some ways to make the beginning seem less foreboding. Or, to put it another way, let me show you how to sneak up on the beginning. One way to do this is to break the question of how shall I begin into three separate questions. I'll call these the artistic question, the logistical question, and the psychological question. The artistic question is simply, what is my story about? What's the idea, the seed, the itch I want to scratch for the next few weeks or months if you're writing a short story, or for the next year or two or three if you're writing a novel? This is the sine qua non of artistic creation. You wouldn't even be facing a blank page if you didn't have an idea you wanted to express. But this doesn't mean that you know everything about your story yet. You may not know who all the characters are or what happens to them or how it ends. But at least you know the ineffable thing you wanted to write a story about in the first place. You might have an entire plot worked out in your head already, or you might have only a character, or a situation, or even just an image you want to explore. But at the very least, you have something that has put you face to face, so to speak, with the blank page. The next question, then, is the logistical question. This question is about the technical aspects of starting a story, the nuts and bolts stuff. All the basic decisions you have to make right at the start, even if you don't know everything about your story. And this question is actually a lot of questions, all rolled up together. Answering these questions, at least in part, involves making specific technical choices right off the bat, such as deciding who's telling the story, what verb tense to use, what voice the story is in, and so on. Even if you already have a clear idea of what your story is, these early choices can be daunting. Because every decision you make will turn out to have consequences later on, many of which you can't foresee. Then, finally, there's the psychological question, or to put it another way, the question of how you gear up emotionally to begin. Even those of us who have written before get anxious about starting, maybe even especially those of us who have done it before, because we already know what a long, arduous, taxing, sometimes exhilarating, but often nerve-shredding process writing can be. All three of these questions, of course, are inextricably intertwined, and trying to leap that psychological hurdle involves being able to answer the first two questions, at least in part. And that, in turn, ratchets up the anxiety, because there's so much stuff you could worry about in advance that it's a wonder anybody ever starts at all. As William Faulkner once famously said, writing a novel is like a one-armed man trying to hammer together a chicken coop in a hurricane. The first two questions, the artistic and the logistical, are especially intertwined, so let's talk about them together. So what do you need to know about a story before you start? Some people start with more or less fully formed plot in their heads. In one edition of The Last Tycoon, the unfinished novel that F. Scott Fitzgerald left behind him when he died, the last portion of the book is made up of Fitzgerald's detailed outline for the plot, in which he not only indicated how many chapters the book would have and what happens in each chapter, but how many words each chapter was going to be. All of this worked out before he even started writing. At the other extreme, some writers start with only an image or a character and then just wing it for 100,000 words. To invoke William Faulkner once again, he once said that when he started work on his greatest novel, The Sound and the Fury, all he had was an image of a little girl wearing muddy underpants hiding in a tree. Yet out of that image, through the process of figuring out who that little girl was, how she dirtied her drawers, and what she was doing up a tree, he created a work as rich, complex, and profound as any novel in American literature. Another way to approach starting a work of fiction is by using the good old-fashioned 5 W's of journalism: who, what, where, when, and why. This technique is very old, dating back to the rhetoricians and philosophers of the ancient and medieval world, who used a Latin version of the 5 W's, quis, quid, ubi, quando, cur, to help frame an argument or structure the exegesis of a text. Most of us recall them from high school or from a college journalism class, where the 5 W's are used to structure a simple newspaper story. What is the story about? What happened? Where did it take place? When did it take place? Why did it happen? Let's adapt the 5 W's to thinking about a piece of fiction, turning them into questions a writer might ask him or herself before embarking upon a new project. Assuming you have a rough idea of what you want to write about, this is another simple but powerful exercise that you might find helpful in getting started. Take out your notebook or your laptop and open to a blank page and just write down who, what, where, when, and why. And again, without thinking too hard about it, answer each question as it pertains to the story you want to tell. Here are a few things to think about before you begin. The first question is, who are your characters, and how are they related to each other? The who question also encompasses the choice of point of view, that is, who is your protagonist or main character, and who is your narrator? Sometimes the narrator and the protagonist are the same person. For example, Jane Eyre is both the narrator and the protagonist of the Charlotte Bronte novel that bears her name. But sometimes the protagonist and the narrator are not necessarily the same person. In Herman Melville's Moby Dick, the protagonist is Captain Ahab, the obsessed whaling captain who wants to kill the great white whale that bit off his leg. But the book is narrated by Ishmael, who is a member of Ahab's crew. And, of course, in many cases, a story is not narrated by any of the characters in the story, but is told by a third-person narrator who can vary from the godlike, seeing into each character's thoughts the way George Eliot does in Middlemarch, to a narrator who's more like a surveillance camera, merely relating what the characters do without revealing their inner lives, the way Dashiell Hammett does in The Maltese Falcon. This is a tricky choice, but also an important one, because who tells your story determines in large part how you answer the next question, which is, what happens in the story? What do your characters do over the course of the story? Another larger interpretation of the what question is, what is your story about? Do you have some larger idea or theme you want to get across? Or are you just telling a ripping yarn with no deeper meaning? Even if it's only the latter, you still have to think about another version of the what question, namely, what effect do you want the story to have on the reader? Do you want to make the reader laugh, cry, be afraid, get angry, or all of the above? The where question seems relatively simple at first glance. Where is the story set? But it leads to a more complex question. How important is the setting to the story? Some stories are very specifically related to a particular time and place. For example, Virginia Woolf's novel, Mrs. Dalloway, is uniquely tied to the city of London in the years right after World War I. But in some cases, it's possible to transfer the plot of a great novel from one setting to another and still have it tell recognizably the same story. The plot and characters of Jane Austen's novel, Emma, for example, were successfully transferred from England in the early 19th century to Los Angeles in the late 20th century in the film comedy Clueless. And Homer's Odyssey, one of the defining stories of Western civilization, has been retold many times in many settings, from James Joyce's great modernist novel Ulysses, set in Dublin on a single day in 1904, to the Coen brothers' film, O Brother, Where Art Thou?, set in the American South during the Great Depression. So, when you answer the question, where is the story set, you have to decide if your story is tied to a specific geographical and historical context, and if it is in part about that place and time, or if it is more archetypical and timeless. The next question, when does the story take place, is likewise more complex than it seems at first. When can mean something as simple as, when in history does the story take place? In other words, does it take place in the present day, or 200 years ago, or 200 years in the future? More importantly, though, is the question, when does the story take place in the lives of the characters? Are they young, middle-aged, or old? And most importantly, when is the story being told in relation to when it took place? In other words, is it being narrated in the present tense as it happens? Or is it being narrated in the past tense by a present-day narrator who is remembering something that happened in the past? A strong present tense narration, as in many of the short stories of Raymond Carver, lends a story immediacy. But more often, you have a first-person narrator remembering something that happened in the past. In Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, for example, the story is told by the main character, Scout, in the past tense, with the implication that she is now a grown woman remembering events that happened decades before, when she was a girl. Among other things, this allows the author to show the events from the point of view of a child, while at the same time allowing the narrator to present things from an adult perspective, allowing her to explain things now that she wouldn't have understood when they were actually happening. If you tell a story in the past tense, you gain the benefit of hindsight, since it's told by someone who already knows how the story turns out. But if you decide to tell it in the present tense, what you lose in hindsight, you might gain in immediacy and suspense. Another aspect of the when question is, at what point in the story does the plot begin? How do you order the events of the plot? Do you tell the story chronologically, as most conventional stories and novels do, or do you tell it backwards? In the play Betrayal, the British writer Harold Pinter tells the story of an adulterous affair by starting with the bitter end of the relationship and then working back through the course of the affair, scene by scene, until he ends with the first meeting of the lovers. Or do you jump all over the place chronologically, the way Joseph Conrad does in his novel Lord Jim, interspersing the present day of the story with flashbacks from various stages in the lives of his characters? Answering this question is at the heart of learning how to construct the plot, because you come to realize that the same series of chronological events can be told in a surprisingly large number of different ways. By deciding what to reveal and when, you're deciding what the most important moments in the plot are. Finally, we have the why question. Why do the characters do what they do? What does each character want? As actors say, what are their motivations? And why are they in the situation they're in? Is it a situation of their own making, as in a lot of American middle-class novels of middle-class life? Or is the character's situation thrust upon them or out of their control, forcing them to deal with it as best they can? Many of the great realist novels of the 19th and 20th centuries, by such writers as the Frenchman Émile Zola and the American Edith Wharton, are about characters caught in the coils of social or economic circumstance, struggling to survive in a world they can't control. Of course, asking why the characters do what they do is both the hardest and the most essential question that you have to answer. And it's not going too far to say that for a lot of writers, maybe even for most of them, answering this question is why they write the novel or story to begin with. To illustrate how the answers to all of these questions might help you get started, let's take a simple story as an example. Let's say we have two characters, Sarah and Brad, who are married to each other. One Friday night, they decide to take in a baseball game. Because I'm a native Michigander, let's say this takes place in Detroit. So they go to see the Tigers play. And during the middle of the seventh inning stretch, Sarah turns to Brad and says, "I'm really unhappy." Now, up to this point, Brad has been having a good time, so he's a little surprised. But it's late in the game, so he says, "Relax, there's only a couple more innings." And that's when Sarah says, "No, you don't understand. I'm really unhappy. I want a divorce." Now, this seems, on the face of it, to be a simple story. You start with two characters in a specific setting, and you tell what happened in chronological order. But then, the climax is a surprise. As soon as Sarah says that she wants a divorce, the story turns out to be more complicated than it seemed at first. Not only that, but the story turns out to have started before the beginning. Sarah's wanted to leave Brad for a long time, but she was afraid to tell him. So she waited until they were at the game, when she knew he'd be happy, or at least groggy with beer and hot dogs, before she lowered the boom. So right away, we understand something about the complex dynamic of the two characters, that Sarah is either afraid of Brad, or manipulative, or both, and that Brad is possibly insensitive or has been deliberately ignoring Sarah's unhappiness. And we learn all this before we get into the long-standing reasons why Sarah is unhappy. There are a couple of lessons to be learned from this example. One is that a story is not mere chronology. Some stories are chronological, but many are not. You might even say that most are not, that most stories rely on backstory. In his famous series of lectures about fiction writing, Aspects of the Novel, the British novelist E.M. Forster made a distinction between story and plot. Story, according to Forster, is just the chronological listing of events. His example of a story is the king died and then the queen died. A plot, on the other hand, according to Forster, is a story plus causality and motivation. The king died, and then the queen died of grief. Another way of looking at this is to consider that all stories begin in medias res, which is a Latin phrase which means in the middle of things. Even stories that seem to begin at the very beginning begin in medias res, the most famous example being the opening of the book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This may not seem like it begins in medias res. You can't get much more in the beginning than in the beginning. But if you think about it, you realize that even Genesis begins in medias res because it presumes a previously existing character namely God. This leads to a larger philosophical point about fiction. As my ninth grade English teacher, Mrs. Giltner, liked to tell us, literature is the creation of order out of chaos and the creation of meaning out of meaninglessness. Stories may feel natural, but stories do not occur in nature. Real life does not happen in stories. Stories are arbitrary. As writers, we imagine a series of events, or we take them out of our life or somebody else's. We order them in a certain way. We choose to highlight some facts and ignore others, and we bring these events and characters to a conclusion or a resolution. The crudest kind of resolution is some sort of victory or defeat, while the more subtle variety leads to a character's deeper understanding of him or herself, or to the reader's deeper understanding of the character, often in a moment that James Joyce called an epiphany. The fact that even a very simple-seeming story can turn suddenly sticky, complicated, and messy in a matter of a few words brings us right back to the difficulty of deciding where to begin. We know the basic facts of Sarah and Brad. They've been married for a while. She's been unhappy. He didn't notice it or chose to ignore it. She's decided to tell him in a public setting. But now, in order to explore this situation, we have to start making choices about what's important to tell, what's not, whose point of view to tell it from, and where in the story, which is to say, when in the story, to begin. So let's go back to the five W's and see if we can apply them usefully to Sarah and Brad in the way I suggested in the exercise above. Who? Sarah and Brad, who are married to each other. What? They are attending a Tigers baseball game, and one of them wants to get divorced while the other one doesn't know it yet. A whole novel could easily be developed from answering this question, working backwards and forwards through their lives. Where? A crowded baseball stadium in Detroit, Michigan. When? The present day. But also some years into a marriage that one of them thinks is less successful than the other one does. Also, for the sake of argument, let's say they're in their late 30s. Why? Sarah wants out. That's the main motivating factor in the story, so far as we know. It may change later on, as we learn more about the characters and their situation. Then the next question becomes, whose story is it? Which is another way of asking, from whose point of view are we seeing the story? Is it Sarah's story, or Brad's, or both, alternating between the two? Or do we go all godlike in 19th century, looking with perfect understanding on both of our characters from above, the way George Eliot does in Middlemarch? Now, even if you've decided on your five W's, you still have to break the ice. You still have to think of those very first words, the very beginning of the story. Do you open with a description that sets the scene? The lights of Tiger Stadium were glowing against the night sky. Or do you open with an exchange of dialogue? Let's see if we can get closer to the dugout, said Brad. Do we have to, said Sarah. Do you open with interior monologue? He looks so happy, thought Sarah, but I'd rather be anywhere but here. Or do you begin with action? Clutching Sarah's hand, Brad dragged her down the stadium steps closer to the dugout. Or do you open with a combination of all of the above? The scoreboard of Tiger Stadium was brilliant against the black sky over the backfield fence. Brad clutched Sarah's hand and dragged her down the stadium steps closer to the dugout. You're hurting me, said Sarah, squeezing between two huge guys who were already drunk. Sorry, said Brad over his shoulder. He relaxed his grip without letting her go. He looked so happy, Sarah thought, but I'd rather be anywhere but here. How do you pick between all these choices? How do you decide without hamstringing yourself, knowing that every choice you make will have consequences later on? One possible solution is to outline the whole story in advance. You could sit down before you start writing and map out the entire thing. Writing the story then just becomes the process of filling in the blanks. Some people work very fruitfully this way. It's sort of how I wrote my novel, Kings of Infinite Space. I never had an actual written outline, but I mulled over the book in my head for a couple of years before I ever wrote a word, and then I wrote it very quickly, in 8 months, because I already knew everything that happened in it. But on the whole, just using myself as an example here, I prefer to work without an outline, as in my novel Next. When I started writing that book, I only knew a couple of things to begin with and then just improvised, making everything up as I went along. This suggests a different way of starting than what I've been talking about so far. Rather than letting the rest of the book determine the beginning, let the beginning determine the rest of the book. Then the book becomes more of an exploration, and the experience of writing it becomes more like the experience of reading it. you discover the story the same way a reader does. Most books, I suspect, fall somewhere between these two poles, tending one way or the other, but still not entirely one or the other. At any rate, it's clear that starting a story involves making a lot of choices, and that in turn can ratchet up your anxiety, which brings us at last to the third question I mentioned at the start, the psychological question. And rather than sharpening our pencils or administering a liberal dose of Jack Daniels or Xanax or both, let's sneak up on this last question the way we snuck up on the first two. Rather than dwelling on all the things you do need to worry about, let's consider what you don't need to do or what you don't need to know when you're starting a story. First of all, you don't have to start at the beginning. Writing a story is not necessarily linear. You don't have to write it the way the reader is going to read it. It can be more like a puzzle, putting a puzzle together. You can start anywhere, and then, when the larger picture gets clearer, you can craft a beginning to it. Second, as a corollary to this, you don't have to know how the story ends. Sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't. Sometimes knowing is a good thing because it gives you a point to aim at. But sometimes it isn't, because you discover along the way that the story doesn't want to go where you want it to go. Third, you don't have to have an outline, and even if you do, you don't have to stick to it. Be prepared for happy accidents. As I said earlier, for me, writing a novel is a process of exploration. Part of the reason I write is to figure out what I think about something. Though, of course, many fine writers already know what they think when they start, and they write to make a point. Fourth, it doesn't have to be good to begin with. One of the mottos I've shared with students over the years comes from the rock and roll musician Nick Lowe. Early in his career, Lowe also worked as a producer for other artists, and he worked so quickly in the studio that someone gave him the nickname Basher, because his motto for making recordings was bash it out now and tart it up later. As a writer, you have the luxury of being able to do as many drafts of a story or a novel as it takes to get it right. Or if you don't do drafts, and some writers don't, you can revise as you go along. Don't be afraid to start over or to go back and fix something no matter where you are in the process. Now, the best teachers, of course, are the ones who teach by example. And in this opening lecture, I have been practicing what I've been preaching. At the beginning of this lecture, I said that a good opening should suggest what the rest of the story is about, or at least hint at what might be important later on. And for the past 25 minutes, I've done more than just hint at what's coming. I've essentially fast-forwarded through the entire course, hitting most, if not all, of the main topics I want to talk about in more detail in the next 23 lectures. In the lecture after this one, I want to talk about the concept of evocation, which I think is at the heart of all fiction. The next 15 lectures will be divided into four blocks. The first one will be about what a fictional character is, how characters work in fiction, and some strategies for creating them. Next will come two lectures about the technical and artistic aspects of writing dialogue. Then I'll talk for six lectures about the various types of plot and how to create them. And after that, I'll devote three lectures to the different points of view available to the writer. Each of the last seven lectures will be devoted to a special topic, including how to create and use setting, how to pace a narrative, and how to develop a scene. We'll also be talking about what a draft is, how to approach revision, and how to incorporate research into a story or novel. Finally, I'll end this particular long narrative with a talk about what it means to live and work as a writer. In that last lecture, I will be half evangelist and half drill sergeant, striking a balance between inspiration and realism. One last word before we embark on this journey together. Having invoked evangelism just now, I want to stress that nothing I've already said or that I'm going to say is gospel. Creative writing isn't a science where there are rules or right or wrong answers. The only rule in creative writing is whatever works. A different teacher will tell you different things about all the topics I'm going to explore. And if you caught me on a different occasion, I might say different things about them myself. What I'll be offering you throughout is a set of choices, and the best way you can use these lectures is to think about the various choices I'll present, about creating character, developing a plot, or building a scene, and then adapt those possibilities to your own work, taking whatever is useful and ignoring the rest. In the next lecture, I'll be talking about the concept of evocation, which is the fancy Latinate word behind what creative writing teachers mean when they say show, don't tell. We'll be looking at examples of both showing and telling from the work of Stephen King and the French novelist Irene Nemirovsky. In the meantime, here's an exercise where you can compare using an outline, the way F. Scott Fitzgerald did, with starting with an image and just winging it, the way William Faulkner did. Without thinking too hard about it, try to recall a vivid image you may have seen recently in your real life or on television, and see if you can imagine a story to explain it. You can start with the Faulkner technique by simply describing the image. Say you saw a mother yelling at her child in the supermarket, and then branching off from there by explaining why the mother is so exasperated or why the child is being so difficult. Or you could use Fitzgerald's technique with the same image by outlining the life of the mother so far, her girlhood, her courtship, the birth of her child, and work up to the moment in the supermarket. Try them both and see which one works best for you, and I'll see you next time.
Lecture 2, Building Fictional Worlds Through Evocation.
One of the most venerable tropes in the teaching of creative writing, or perhaps one of the hoariest, is the old saying, show, don't tell. If you've ever taken a creative writing class, you've heard it, and if you've ever taught a creative writing class, you've said it. In fact, there have been times when I've considered getting a stamp made up just to save myself the trouble of having to write it out so often when I was reading student work. I could just bang it in the margin of a story. Show, don't tell. Show, don't tell. Show, don't tell. Not only would this have saved me a lot of time, it would have been pretty satisfying. But show, don't tell is used so often that most writers cringe when they hear it, and most teachers cringe when they have to say it. It's become such a cliché that even talking about how it's a cliché, as I'm doing right now, has become a cliché in itself. So what exactly do we mean when we say, show, don't tell? In the case of those student stories, what I usually meant was that the scene or story was under-dramatized, or that the writer trafficked in vague generalities rather than specific details. For example, the writer would tell us something that was generally true about a character without associating that trait or action with a specific moment or situation. So the writer might say, she fixed herself a drink, which evokes nothing in particular, even if you already know something about the character. What I would suggest in a case like this was that the writer show us the character in a specific setting at a specific time. After dining out that night at a nearby Italian restaurant, she knelt in the light of the open mini-fridge in her hotel room, pulled out a little bottle of gin and a little bottle of tonic, and made herself a drink in a plastic cup. Now, both of these sentences convey the same essential information, but the second one is more immediate, vivid, detailed, sensuous, and visceral. In the first version, the writer is merely telling us what the character did. But in the second, the writer is showing us the character in action, putting her within a specific setting and showing us specifically what she did. In the second version, we as readers are invited to see and feel what the character is doing, which allows us to identify with the character. In other words, showing rather than telling blurs the boundary between the character and the reader, which allows us as readers, and this is the important part, to participate in the scene, if only in our imagination. Let's take a look at a longer example. Here's a bare-bones version of a scene, one that is told rather than shown. I was driving home from work this afternoon when some jerk came out of a side street and cut right in front of me. I was angry about something my boss had said, so instead of letting it go, I sounded my horn and tailgated the guy for half a mile. He pulled over, and we nearly got into a fight. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. It's brisk, it's concise, it gets the facts across, it even has a bit of psychology, namely the fact that the narrator let his anger over something else affect his behavior behind the wheel of his car. But by the standards of modern prose fiction, it's woefully underdramatized. The reader has no idea from the storyteller what it was like to be there in that particular setting at that particular time. What showing does that telling doesn't is put the reader in the scene with the characters. Taking that same set of events, here's what a fiction writer might do with it. That afternoon, I left work angry. Just before I'd switched off my computer, my boss had come into my office with a file I'd just given her. A file I was pretty proud of, if you want to know the truth. and told me 6 things I needed to do over. I like my boss, but at times like this, she talks to me like I'm 6 years old. And I responded like I was 6, crossing my arms and pushing out my lower lip and saying yes, 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 so insincerely, I was surprised she didn't send me to my room without supper. When I finally left, I was radiating rage in the stairwell and letting it ricochet off the concrete beams of the parking structure. It's a wonder I didn't set off every car alarm in the place. And of course, I fumed all the way home, riding the accelerator with a foot as heavy as a diving boot, switching from lane to lane, rushing yellow lights, scowling at the speed limit signs as if they were another admonition from my boss. So naturally, as I was just about to cross the river, a guy in a Jeep Cherokee with enormous tires shot out right in front of me and cut me off. Worse yet, he was a young guy with big redneck sideburns and a feed cap. And when I honked my horn, he gave me the finger and a big nasty grin. All of this, along with my rage at my boss, made me erupt. Even then, there was a little part of my brain, a little Jiminy Cricket sitting just behind me and to the left saying, "What on earth are you doing?" I rammed my horn with the heel of my hand and kept it there all the way across the bridge. And even more surprising, I rode right up behind the guy's dented rear bumper. Of course, it's hard to be intimidating when you're in a Honda Civic tailgating a Jeep Cherokee, but at the moment I didn't care, and I told Jiminy Cricket to go to hell. Then, of course, at the end of the bridge, where the traffic was piled up at the light, and I was hemmed in by cars on one side and the railing of the bridge on the other, Mr. Jeep Cherokee slammed on his brakes and got out of his car, all 6'3", bench-pressing, denim-clad inch of him. Then, and only then, did Jiminy Cricket get the upper hand, and I heard myself say out loud, "Maybe this wasn't such a good idea." Now, you'll note that the outline of the two versions is the same, but the second version has a lot more detail. Instead of a guy shot out in front of me, it's a young guy with sideburns and a baseball cap who's driving an SUV with a dented rear bumper. And he not only cuts the narrator off, he seems to enjoy it. And we can tell from the voice of the narrator that he's a different social class than the young guy, that he's an office worker driving an economy car. It's essentially the same story, but I've fleshed it out with many more details about the two characters, about the narrator's mood, namely exactly why he's ticked off on his way home from work, and about the setting. You're in the head of the narrator. You're seeing the scene as if you're there. So this is what creative writing teachers mean when they say show, don't tell. They mean, 1, give us more detail. 2, make it more dramatic. 3, put the reader in the scene. Writing fiction by showing rather than telling means bypassing the logical, analytical mind and going for the gut, engaging the reader's senses, not just her mind. More importantly, you're engaging the reader's imagination and allowing her to fill in the gaps by drawing on her own experience. What you should be doing, in fact, and here's the word I've been sneaking up on for the last 10 minutes, what you should be doing is evoking the experience for the reader. That's a word I want you to remember all throughout this course. Evocation and its verb to evoke and its adjective evocative. For me, the idea of evocation is at the heart of all fiction. It's the thing that makes it work, that makes it memorable, that allows a fictional story and imaginary characters to lodge themselves ineradicably in a reader's head. And it's a word I want to take a few minutes to explain. The variants of the word evoke come from the Latin word evocare, which means to call out, in several different senses. To summon the spirits of the dead, to call forth a deity, or simply to summon another person. In English, when talking specifically about art and literature, the dictionary definition of evocative is tending by artistic, imaginative means to recreate as a mood, time, place, or personality, especially in such a manner as to produce a compelling impression of reality. That's from Webster's Third International Dictionary. But there's more to it than that. In English, as in Latin, evoke, evocative, and evocation can also mean calling out or calling forth, summoning a spirit by incantation, calling up an emotional response, or calling up memories, recollections, or associations. You can evoke a response from someone. You can evoke fear or love in someone. You can evoke in someone a vivid memory from time gone by. All of these meanings apply when it comes to writing fiction, because all of these definitions have in common the idea of drawing something out of a reader's imagination and not just putting something new into it. This is so important that I want to say it again. When the writer is evoking something for the reader, she is drawing it out of the reader, not simply telling the reader something. She is engaging the reader's imagination and reminding the reader of something from his or her own life. This is the fundamental difference between telling and showing. When you are telling a reader something, you're not engaging him as deeply. You're appealing mainly to the rational, analytical mind and not to the senses. On the other hand, when you are showing the reader something, or more precisely, when you are evoking something for the reader, you are drawing something out of that reader that was already there, even if she didn't know it, namely memories and imaginings of her own that can fill in the gaps of what the writer is merely suggesting. In other words, when you simply tell a reader something, you're making her a witness. But when you show her something, you're making her a participant. You're putting her in the story with the characters. So you can see that evocation is both a subtle and a very powerful technique. As its etymology suggests, it works both ways. It's not just the author planting images in the reader's mind, images that the reader receives in the passive way a viewer watches a movie or a TV show. It's about drawing those images, in part, out of the reader's memory and imagination. Evocation depends on the reader meeting the author halfway. It means that both the writer and the reader are using their imaginations. The writer uses his skill with words to call forth the scene from his own imagination in enough detail that the reader, without really thinking about it, uses his own imagination and memory to fill in the gaps. And in so doing, memories are evoked, emotions are evoked, sensory impressions are evoked. Evocation, as it pertains to creative writing, even has something of the spiritual about it, in the sense of evoking the spirit of a scene or a character, drawing it out of the reader. Now, here's the great thing about evocation. The reader may be doing half the work, but he doesn't know it. In fact, not only doesn't he know he's working, he's enjoying it. This feeling of being in a scene with the characters, of being engaged by the narrative and not just watching it, is one of the greatest pleasures in reading fiction, perhaps even the greatest pleasure. The American novelist and creative writing teacher John Gardner once defined fiction as the creation of a vivid and continuous dream. And I think that phrase brilliantly captures the effect that great fiction has on the reader. We feel as if we are living in someone else's life for a few hours. We feel as if we are seeing the world through their eyes. As Gardner himself put it in his book, The Art of Fiction, in great fiction, the dream engages us heart and soul. We not only respond to imaginary things, sights, sounds, smells, as though they were real. We respond to fictional problems as though they were real. We sympathize, think, and judge. We act out vicariously the trials and successes of particular modes of action, particular attitudes, opinions, assertions, and beliefs, exactly as we learn from life. Another great creative writing teacher, Janet Burroway, puts it even more succinctly in her book, Writing Fiction, when she says that reading fiction allows us to feel strong emotions without paying for them. This is what evocation is all about. When you get the reader to laugh, you're evoking her joy. When you get the reader to sweat and turn the light up a notch, you're evoking his fear. When you get the reader aroused, you're evoking her desire. You're not just getting the reader to visualize him or herself in a certain situation. You're getting them to feel something about it, to engage with it emotionally in the same way they would as if they were actually experiencing it in real life. And if you don't believe me, or John Gardner, or Janet Burroway, consider this. In recent years, neuroscientists have discovered that the same parts of a person's brain that light up in a CAT scan, when he is merely thinking of playing chess, for example, are the same parts of his brain that light up when he's actually playing chess. In the same way, experiments have shown that a scary story can make us feel real fear without actually putting us in danger, or make us sad without forcing us to experience a genuine loss. So, since we're speaking of scary stories, let's take an example from one of the best horror stories ever written, Stephen King's vampire novel, Salem's Lot. Here's a passage in which King is evoking the arrival of spring in New England. By mid-May, the sun rises out of the morning's haze with authority and potency. And standing on your top step at 7 a.m. with your dinner bucket in your hand, you know that the dew will be melted off the grass by 8, and that the dust on the back roads will hang depthless and still in the hot air for 5 minutes after a car's passage, and that by 1 p.m. it will be up to 95 on the third floor of the mill, and the sweat will roll off your arms like oil and stick your shirt to your back in a widening patch, and it might as well be July. This is wonderfully evocative, not only of the growing heat and stillness of a spring day, but of a working-class way of life. And even if you've never carried a lunch bucket or worked in a mill, you can feel what that third floor feels like. You can feel that sweat roll off your arms. You can feel that shirt stick to your back, all because you are supplying the details from your own experience. By evoking memories we all have of heat and dew and dust, King is able to draw us out of our own lives into the life of a man who works in a mill. You're doing half of Stephen King's work for him in this passage, but you don't even have to break a real sweat doing it. This passage is a wonderful example of how evocation works, because there's a nice balance in the paragraph between detail and economy. I've already stressed that one of the signature features of evocative writing, perhaps the signature feature, is the prolific use of detail. But the other requirement of evocative writing is that it be economical. An evocative piece of writing does not try to set the scene by brute force. It does not overwhelm the reader with too much detail. In other words, as I've already said, what makes a passage or a sentence evocative is when it draws something out of the reader. And you can't draw anything out of the reader if you're pouring too much in. By putting in just the right amount of detail, the sun rising through the haze, the dew burning off the grass, the sweat-soaked shirt sticking to the skin, and then leaving it to the reader to fill in the rest of the picture in her mind, you're engaging the reader in a much more subtle and effective way. Now, this is a tricky balance to get right, even for the most experienced writer, but beginning writers often have the most difficulty with it. Just as one common error among young writers is not showing us nearly enough detail, another common error is to overcompensate by telling us too much. Often, an inexperienced writer will go on and on and on for paragraph after paragraph about the appearance of a character or a place when only a few well-chosen sentences, or even just a few well-chosen words, would have done. But what, you may ask, are the right details to include? How do you know which words to choose? Well, having just said that it's a rookie mistake to include too much detail, I'm going to backtrack a bit and say this instead. It may be a rookie mistake to include too much detail in the finished product, but it is not a mistake to use too much detail in your early drafts. I can't speak for every writer, of course, and perhaps there are writers who have never wasted a word, even in an early draft. But I'm guessing that most writers, especially in their early drafts, write much more than they need, and then pare it back later on the principle that it's easier to cut what you don't need than to go back into a passage which has already fixed itself in your head and wedge more stuff in. This is how I work anyway, and while it's certainly inefficient, it's very effective. Say I'm describing a place which is important to the story, and that's another trick to the art of evocation. You don't waste time on details that aren't important to the larger narrative. I often write twice as much stuff as I need, putting in every detail I can think of. Then later, when the shape of the scene and how it fits into the larger story are clearer to me, I return to that mass of details and keep the ones I need and get rid of the ones I can do without. Indeed, sometimes in revising a scene for maximum evocative effect, I make a little game out of it, trying to see how many words I can delete from a passage without diminishing its effect. Deciding which details to keep and which to discard isn't purely intuitive, though with practice it can become so. There are logical rules you can apply to every moment in a story, though what those rules are will depend on the individual story you're writing. But some examples might be, does this detail tell us something we don't already know? Does it advance the story? Does it say something about the character that's specific to the scene? The rules I most often use have to do with the nature of the details themselves, especially, are they visceral? Are they concrete? Do they appeal directly to the senses? For example, don't just say, he was in love with her, but say something like,
He felt his face get hot when she came into the room. Don't just say she found the noise grating, but say the noise made her grit her teeth and dig her fingernails into her palms and so on. Another thing to consider in making a passage evocative is the language itself. There are no rules in creative writing, but on the whole, evocation works best when you use active, specific verbs and avoid adverbs unless they're absolutely necessary. This is another rookie mistake you often find in inexperienced writers. They write something like, she hurried quickly across the room, or he pounded the table angrily. In these examples, it's already clear from the verb hurry that she's being quick, and the fact that he's pounding the table makes it pretty obvious that he's angry. And remember to bear down on the language and use the strongest verbs you can think of. It was raining is not very evocative. It was raining hard is slightly better, but not by much. While the rain hammered the roof and spattered the windows like buckshot is much better. Instead of starting with the bland pronoun it and the even blander verb was, we start with the rain itself, making it the subject of the sentence. And with the strong verb hammered, we evoke not only an image, but a sound, and we render any adverbs superfluous. You wouldn't need to say, the rain hammered hard, for example, because hammered already implies that the rain is coming down hard. The second half of the sentence evokes the wind without actually mentioning the wind, because saying that the rain spattered the windows like buckshot implies a strong wind, evoking an image and a sound all in one go. Now, having spent the last 20 minutes or so stressing the importance of evocation to fiction, I'm going to spend the last few minutes taking it back a little bit. As much as writing students hate to hear show, don't tell, writing teachers hate saying it even more. And that's because sometimes it's perfectly okay, and sometimes even preferable, to tell a story rather than show it. Many of the great books of the 18th and early 19th centuries use telling as their default mode. In her novels, Jane Austen often simply tells us what a character is thinking or simply summarizes an action. There's also a long tradition in European literature of narratives that privilege telling over showing, especially in philosophical novels or novels of ideas, such as Milan Kundera's The Unbearable Lightness of Being. There is also a long tradition of a certain sort of short story writer, especially those influenced by the great Russian short story writer and playwright Anton Chekhov, who tell more than they show. A fine example, in fact, is Anton Chekhov's own great story, The Darling, which has little intense bursts of drama that serve mainly as seasoning for the main meal of the story, which is told rather than shown. Another genre that often relies heavily on telling rather than showing is satire. Much of Catch-22, Joseph Heller's great anti-war novel about World War II, is told rather than shown, as Heller summarizes characters and situations with his scathing wit. But even in a more conventional narrative, where much of the story is shown or evoked, there are going to be long passages in which the writer or the narrator simply addresses the reader and tells her what she needs to know. Just as a composer might vary the tempo of a piece of music to maintain the listener's interest, or a chef might provide diners with a variety of courses that each hit the palate in a different place, the fiction writer needs to vary between intensely evocative scenes, passages of pure exposition, and even scenes that are a little bit of both. In other words, show, don't tell, unless, of course, you just need to tell the reader something. There are any number of ways of doing this. In some varieties of popular fiction, science fiction and fantasy in particular, there is often a passage or even an entire chapter early in the narrative known as the info dump, whereby the author takes a few pages to simply explain the world of the story before he even introduces a character or starts the narrative. Many great literary novels have long passages of simply telling. George Eliot's Middlemarch, one of the greatest novels ever written, opens with a straightforward description of one of its main characters, Dorothea Brooke, that is not tied to any particular setting or specific moment, and it goes on for four solid pages before we get an actual scene with action and dialogue. Even in a highly dramatic popular novel like the aforementioned Salem's Lot, there are passages between the dramatic scenes where Stephen King simply tells us what's going on and what's up with the characters. Another excellent example of a careful balance between telling and showing, between exposition and evocation, is Irene Nemirovsky's novel Sweet Francaise, which despite being tragically incomplete, the author died in Auschwitz before she could finish it, is one of the greatest works of literature to have come out of World War II. It's about the Nazi occupation of France from the point of view of a variety of French characters, and some of it is exquisitely evocative, like this passage from the point of view of a French woman who has fallen in love with a German officer who has been billeted in her house as she waits for him to come home. Finally, the sound of his horse neighing on the road, the clanking of weapons, orders given to the groom who walks away with the horse, the sound of spurs on the doorstep, then the night, the stormy night, with its great gusts of wind in the lime trees and the thunder rumbling in the distance. She would tell him. Oh, she was no hypocrite. She would tell him in clear, simple French that the prey he so desired was his. And then what? Then what? She murmured. A mischievous, bold, sensual smile suddenly transformed her expression, just as the reflection of a flame illuminating a face can alter it. Lit up by fire, the softest features can look demonic. They can both repel and attract. This is showing rather than telling, because what we get vividly from this passage is that the woman is passionately in love with the German officer, that she desires him. But nowhere in the passage does Nemirovsky say or tell us that she's in love. Instead, her intense longing is evoked by vivid and specific sights and sounds, the sound of his spurs, the gusts of wind in the lime trees, the rumble of thunder in the distance, and the demonic look of desire on her face as if lit by fire. Contrast this with another passage from the book, a straightforward, expository description of a different German officer. Like many young men subjected to strict discipline from childhood, he had acquired the habit of bolstering his ego with outward arrogance and stiffness. He believed that any man worthy of the name should be made of steel, and he had behaved accordingly during the war in Poland and France and during the occupation. But far more than any principles, he obeyed the impulsiveness of youth. He behaved kindly or cruelly depending on how people and things struck him. If he took a dislike to someone, he made sure he hurt them as much as possible. On the other hand, he would behave with infinite kindness and sympathy towards certain prisoners who seemed likable to him. This is also vivid in its way, and we certainly get a clear idea of the officer, but we aren't drawn into this passage the way we are drawn into the scene with the woman in love, or the way we would be if Nemirovsky had taken a moment to dramatize some of this officer's acts of cruelty or kindness. The adjectives and metaphors used to describe him are definitive but generic. He's arrogant, stiff, and made of steel, qualities that could describe countless officers in the German army at the time. He isn't really singled out as an individual. But then, and here's my point, we don't need to see him as vividly as we see the woman because he's not as important to the story as she is. He is, in other words, a secondary character whose main function in the plot is to get killed by a jealous French husband later on. And to be sure, we do see him in action in several scenes, but under the circumstances, on our first meeting with him, it makes perfect sense for the author to simply present him to us fully formed. As it happens, I'm going to be talking about creating characters for the next four lectures, and I'll come back to how evocation applies to character development. In my first lecture about character, however, I'll be talking about how characters, fictional characters, are different from real people. And we'll be taking a look at three characters in particular, from Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, and Dashiell Hammett's The Maltese Falcon. In the meantime, here's an exercise in evocation you might try. It's one of the exercises from John Gardner's The Art of Fiction. Write a passage describing a building, a landscape, or an object, but imagine you're writing from the point of view of a parent whose child has just died. The interesting part of the exercise is that all you're allowed to do is describe the object without mentioning the parent, the child, or death. The idea is to see if you can evoke the feeling of loss and grief in the reader without mentioning either, the way Nemirovsky evokes love and desire without mentioning either of them in the passage I quoted earlier. It sounds daunting. Give it a try. You might surprise yourself.
Lecture 3, How Characters Are Different from People.
One of the curious facts about the emotional life of human beings is that some of the most vivid, memorable, and influential people in our lives have never existed at all. I'm talking, of course, about fictional characters. And the funny thing about them is that many of the people who are most familiar